Tonight's forum arises out of one of the Bible studies that Elmer Witt was leading earlier this week, guiding us with this book, Mark as Story, through a consideration of the Gospel of Mark. We got into a lively discussion on the question of divorce and remarriage in the midst of that Bible study, and that's what has led us to focus tonight's forum on divorce, till death do us part, perspectives, Christian perspectives on divorce and remarriage. I want to invite us to reflect together about that question, both from the perspective of Jesus' time and from the perspective of our own time, where we know that divorce and remarriage is a paramount concern to many of us. And I'm sure any and many of us could share stories from our own families and circles of friends and congregations about stories of pain and sorrow and of new beginnings and joy, of death and resurrection. I want to invite us to get the forum underway by first listening to that brief section of the story of Mark's gospel that got us going the other day, and then to share some brief excerpts from Joachim Jeremias' book, Jerusalem in the Time of Jesus, to describe what divorce and marriage was like in the context in which Jesus is speaking in Mark's gospel, and then invite Rich Anderson from our staff here to share some reflections that he shared with us on adultery at that Bible study earlier this week. But then to throw it open for discussion and to invite us to share very openly and freely in a context of trust and acceptance, knowing that the views that are shared here are kept here and are open and shared with the rest of the world through the tape ministry. But that this is a context of trust and tolerance and acceptance. And I hope that as we probably don't come to any definitive conclusion tonight, but that in the sharing of the opinions and feelings and stories, that we might come to a clarified understanding of where we are as a people and as a church. So the text from Mark's Gospel. And if your hand causes you to stumble, cut it off. It's better for you to enter into life maimed than with two hands to go off to Gehenna, to the inextinguishable fire. And if your foot causes you to stumble, cut it off. It's better for you to enter into life lame than with two feet to be thrown into Gehenna. And if your eye causes you to stumble, pull it out. It's better for you with one eye to enter into the rule of God than with two eyes to be thrown into Gehenna, where their maggots don't die and the fire isn't extinguished. For everyone will be salted with fire. Salt is good. But if salt becomes saltless, how will you make it season? Have salt among yourselves and be at peace with each other. From there, Jesus arose and went to the region of Judea and across the Jordan. Again, crowds gathered around him, and as it had been his custom, again Jesus was teaching them. Pharisees approached and asked Jesus if it were legal for a husband to divorce his wife, testing him. Answering, he said to them, "What did Moses order you?" They said, "Moses permitted him to write a certificate of divorce and to divorce her." Jesus said to them, "Because of your callous minds, he wrote you this ordinance. But from the beginning of creation, he made them male and female. For this reason, a man will leave his father and mother behind, and the two will be as one flesh, so that no longer are they two but one flesh. So what God yoked together, a man is not to separate." And in the house, again, the disciples asked Jesus about this. And he said to them, "Whoever divorces his wife and marries another commits adultery against her. And if that woman divorcing her husband marries another, she commits adultery." People were bringing to him little children so he might touch them, but the disciples rebuked them. Now when Jesus saw it, he got angry and said to them, "Let the little children come to me. Don't stop them, for the rule of God belongs to such as these." According to Jeremias, and the irony is it's from a chapter entitled "The Social Position of Women," and it's put in as an appendix. The times don't change. According to Yeremias, the status of women in the culture and society was really distant. They were secluded. There was no place for them in the public life of the community. And similarly, in the position of the house, the place of the daughter was well behind that of the son, so that in any inheritance, it would go to the sons and the descendants of the sons before it would go to a daughter of the family. Education was limited to domestic arts for women. Around puberty, sort of 12 and a half was the magic age by which one ceased to become a child and became an adult. Up until the age of 12 years and one day, a young girl was literally the property and possession of her father. From 12 to 12 and a half, she was referred to as a young girl, still under the domain of her father's power. And at the age over 12 and a half, she was a maiden of full age. Up to 12 and a half, a girl could not refuse a marriage made by her father, arranged by her father. A father could and often did sell a daughter into slavery. But at 12 and a half, a woman became somewhat independent in that she could not be betrothed against her will. She had to approve of the marriage that was arranged by her father. A daughter was looked upon as really as cheap labor and as a possibility of profit. The betrothal transferred the father's power to that of the husband. There were therefore often clan marriages within the family. And as I'm describing this, keep in your in once whichever side of the brain you want to use, what goes on in our time? In terms of when does a woman become independent? What is the relationship of child to parent? How are marriages arranged or come to fulfillment in our time? So marriages were often within the clan, often to close relatives, even to first cousins. Marriage contracts were the norm, so that a betrothed woman, while called a wife already in the betrothal, could become a widow, be put away by divorce, or punished with death for adultery. There was very little distinction, both in legal understanding, between a wife and a slave. Marriage followed the betrothal within 1 year. The wife usually went to live with the husband's family, so she was displaced and out of her home environment at a very young age, 12 and a half, 13 years. The marriage contract stipulated a sum of money would be paid to the wife in the event of separation or death of husband. And Yeremias gives several contract stipulations, the duties of the wife to manage the home, look after the husband, care for the children. Anything the wife earned became the husband's. Anything the wife found became the husband's. There were some very slim rules by which a wife could initiate the divorce proceedings. If her husband belonged to one of three repugnant trades, which included dung gatherer. Where's page 308? A dung gatherer, or a tanner, or appropriate to Holden, a copper smelter. Apparently because of the smells associated with those trades. Or some diseases. If the husband became a leper, the wife could initiate divorce. There was a low divorce rate, principally for two reasons. There was a public stigma attached to divorce, both for the wife and for the husband and for the daughters of that marriage. There was a public stigma. And maybe more importantly, there was a financial penalty that the husband would have to pay the wife if he filed a bill of divorce. So according to Yeremias, he gives some statistics from Josephus' histories of the time of a relatively low divorce rate, I think 4% in a couple of towns that were surveyed. And contrast that with our own time. But Rich, if I could ask you to bring yet another perspective to this discussion and to share your comments from the other day about adultery.
My recollection from the Bible study was that the big issue was, what do we do with what Jesus said? And that is, if you remarry, you commit adultery. And I think it may be important to reread those lines again. I listened to them real closely. I believe it says, if a man divorces his wife and then marries another woman, he commits adultery against her. If a woman divorces her husband and marries another man, she commits adultery, but not against the new husband. I think those are some interesting distinctions and maybe things we need to talk about. But just quickly, the point I brought up at the Bible study was, traditionally, I think we think about adultery as a sexual act that is committed with someone that is not your marriage partner. And I think it might be beneficial for us to broaden our understanding of adultery beyond becoming sexually involved with an individual to other acts and allegiances and loyalties and emotional attachments to people and things and behaviors and jobs and hobbies and activities that we get involved in that become more important to us than our relationship with our spouse. People I know that are more involved in their duck hunting and their equipment to go duck hunting and their fishing and their this and this and their snowmobiles and all their Minnesota type toys, that takes precedent over their relationship with their wife or their relationship with their children. And is that adulterous within their marriage? Wives tolerate that all the time. But I think it seriously affects the intimacy of their marital relationship. And I guess the question I want to raise is, can you remain legally married and still be divorced relationally? Can you be in a legal marriage and still be involved in committing adultery where your heart really is something in something else than in your relationship with your spouse? And is that adulterous? Even though there's no sex involved, no other person involved. Or maybe another person involved, but no sex involved.
I'd like to know, what is the technical definition of adultery in the dictionary?
I don't know.
It's kind of the library.
We seem to write those definitions.
Yeah, I'd like to add something that's somewhat colorful about that. When I first got my first dictionary, when I was in high school, it said something to the effect that it's an illicit sexual act between a married man or woman and another man or woman, not their husband or wife. I later wore out that dictionary and had to get another one. And that definition was exactly the same, except it took out illicit. I throw that open to the sociologists of the group.
Does that mean it was narrower definition? So any relationship would be adulterous?
No, it was exactly the same. It's a sexual act between...
Yeah. But without the word,
it was no longer illicit.
Yeah. Oh, I was just saying whether it meant that adultery was not just an illicit act, but any act between two people.
No, it was a sexual act between...
Well, I mean any sexual act.
Right. But they took out the one word, illicit.
They took out the first word.
I'm just wondering whether they intended it to be more narrower or what. We would immediately read it as broad. And I'm wondering whether they meant it that way or not. I wonder if they meant it
to
be narrow.
I think they took the moral tones out of it.
That's the way I...
Sign of the time. They didn't look at it as illicit anymore. It's just an app. Not defining it morally.
I certainly understand that definition, but I'm not sure that's the only definition that would be reachable from that statement.
Maybe what I'm saying is the dictionary might want to consider changing your definition to include things other than sexual.
Well, again, they didn't. They left in the sexual, but took out the unlawful.
Well, language is a floating thing, and...
words don't mean exactly what they used to mean 30 to 40 years ago. So it probably will be updating it to include things that you've mentioned.
I know with marriage couples that I've dealt with, I had some wives tell me, I wish you'd gone out and had an affair. It would have been easier to deal with.
Easier than?
Than his allegiance to this other kind of thing that he really is more married to than her.
That's easy to say when it's not happening. My experience is that when it is happening, that it's easier to forget and forgive somebody cheating on their spouse by going to the job 70 hours a week than it is to forget and forgive someone involved with another person.
What was the meaning of the word adultery in the days in which this was written?
I tried to find that out. And I, in a quick survey of this book, I was unable to find it. I think, please somebody help me and correct me if that's the case, but I think it was principally sexual in that context, particularly with the death penalty being a consequence of I'm an adulteress, yes. An adulteress.
For women only.
Yes.
I think we have to understand it in the framework of the language of the time.
But let's also talk about Jesus' attempt to redefine it. When you look at another woman with lust, you've taken you've committed adultery in your heart. Jesus telling us adultery can happen with your eyes and your fantasy mind and in your heart. And I think in that sense, Jesus is telling us maybe it's more than sexual acts.
When you read that in tandem with the fact that he forgave the woman so readily who was to him.
Mm-hmm. And said, described it in terms of the sexual relationship. Even there.
Or sexual lust, maybe, yeah. But not necessarily a relationship.
But they're saying out of the heart proceed these thoughts. So therefore it would have that intent of impurity or lack of commitment or transgression, would it not? And already he says that thoughts themselves can be the sin.
Sure.
But in the passage that we're trying to deal with here, he's not describing ways that people can damage their marriage. He's using the term adultery to describe a relationship when someone has put away their spouse and been joined with another, and that's what makes it such a difficult thing for Christian people today to deal with. I mean, if all of these other things are true, you know, we can waste away our marriage by our adulterous affairs with our job and with somebody at the job and with hobbies and with church, can have adulterous affairs with church. And yet, what is he saying about our obligation to stay in a marriage once we're in a marriage? And I think that's the crux of the discussion.
Or to remarry after divorce.
Yeah.
Yeah, I really think it's the remarriage that seems to be the biggest problem in the reading. If he doesn't seem to condemn a man who puts away his wife until he marries another, then we have an adulterous relationship, and that seems to be the problem.
Maybe someone else can help me, but I vaguely recall somewhere understanding this passage as dealing with regulations regarding marriage for women that were saying back then that if a woman was married and then divorced, she could never marry again If she did, she was committing adultery. But a man, if he was married and then divorced, could remarry again if he married a woman who had never been married without committing adultery. But if he married a woman who had been married before, he was committing adultery against her.
That's not the way I read Mark. He's pretty explicit. He doesn't hem and haw and say, well, if she was married, the new wife was married before, it's adultery. If she wasn't, there's no adultery. He says he commits adultery against their wife. He committed this sin against her.
That's the difficulty of that. What does it mean to commit adultery against somebody? That's different from committing adultery, is it not? When you suddenly commit adultery against somebody? I mean, the person that you're having sex with, you're committing adultery against that person. It isn't adultery against an objective statement of what marriage is, but it's against this person. And it seems to me the simplicity of the words are the trap. What if this was about the fifth commandment? What if this were about the eighth? How would it be? What's the opposite of killing?
Killing life.
Yeah, giving life. Would it say something about that if you harmed somebody else and then later on you harmed them again? What would be parallel? That bothers me that this one of all of them is taken out and made it to it. And first of all, we all have a problem with sex in the first place. We ought to admit that. We're all sexually, that's a nice word, mixed up. We were taught by pietists only three or four generations removed who believed actually that the body was sinful. That we're only three generations from that. The people who taught you, some of us older, the people who taught us, were trained by pietists who absolutely believed the body was evil. And that was true. So you know, we come out of that context. That doesn't answer our question. But I'm wondering what the difficulty we have because it happens to be connected with sex. You know, I wonder what we would say if we had similar words about the commandment of gossip. What would be the repetition that would cause it to happen in another way? There tends to be, or what is Jesus' objective in the command? What is Jesus' new understanding of the commandments? The law stands, but he gives new understanding to everything. You know, they said this, what I said. As I read the Gospels, and I'm trying to have an answer, but my feelings are that he was always pointing out how commandments give life. They were meant to give life. The fifth commandment, thou shalt not kill, was not meant to stop murder. I don't believe it was. I believe it was meant to enrich life, that we were about enriching life. The wrong thing in the commandment is that it didn't enrich life. I mean, the wrong thing in killing is that it didn't enrich life. And we weren't about organizing people so that we won't kill. It was to be fully into the business of giving life wherever we are. If the objective of the commandment, say, for gossip or whatever maybe, then what about the commandment thou shalt not commit adultery. I don't think that it was about stopping people inserting penises into vaginas. But that it was about how do people live enriched lives together. So I am saying if that would be true, then I wonder if the commandment, this prohibition has to be what we discover now in psychology and everything else happening, that it's really dumb. It's really dumb. Now, portray that as evil. You know, some of the best law was taught by Mad Magazine, which made everything look dumb. One of the best law books ever created, it seems, was Mad Magazine. That means that it was evil and that it was destructive. Now I get to the point of how does that become undestructive if you're trying to deal with it after the fact that it happened? Where does the enrichment part come in this commandment? Or could we be tricked in any one of the commandments into making new rules out of them that maybe weren't as intended by Jesus' commitment to giving life and giving it fully abundantly. Is that, I don't know if that makes sense. I don't think there's an answer, but it's a perspective that I think is moving more deeply towards a Christian, Christ life enrichment perspective.
I think when you look at the small catechism, you see that Luther's explanation is taking the Ten Commandments beyond the thou shalt nots into what thou shalt. And in working with the young people, when we do that commandment, all those commandments, I try to move them beyond I shouldn't take a knife and kill somebody, but thank you for those things. So your comments make me wonder, in a male-dominated society, is it to get the attention of the man and say, you don't just think about yourself, you're condemning the woman. And so maybe it's a beginning step of some feminist theology. That's a quick thought that came to mind. Maybe it's to help the women who have been abused, to get them to stop and think.
I think one step further than that, that if Mark is writing this to the early Christian community, it's probably in there as a reminder. You had brought out a Bible study that Mark's gospel is all about projecting what's supposed to be like when the kingdom finally comes, and giving that as an ideal to the community. This is what we're supposed to be out about, to create this kind of world. To say that as a Christian community, we have a heavy responsibility to support marriage so that this kind of thing doesn't happen, so that it doesn't get fractured this way. Now, 20 centuries later, with all the psychology and everything that we have, I look at that and say we have a heavy responsibility to create an understanding of marriage and make it public and clear to young people that it's a tough road to hoe, that it's a real commitment, that it's the most joyful thing you'll ever do, only because it's the toughest thing you'll ever do. And so that they don't go walking into this starry-eyed like it's another day for the senior prom, and they understand that this is a terribly serious commitment to each other in the community. And that after that, we provide help for them getting into marriage, support for them out of our experience. We've been married 18 years now, this summer. About 5 years ago, something like that, we hit the bottom. We got married with all of the understanding and with more than average education and up to here with Christian theology of marriage. I mean, name it. I teach it. And we bottomed out. I mean, I was in there teaching covenant of marriage and going home and thinking, dear God, how am I going to live another day like this? I'm teaching this one thing. And every time we look at it, we've lost it. And there was a community of people around us that helped. They were like a safety net. I mean, in times when we forgot what we loved about each other, they kept us together, and they'd invite us out, and we'd go out to Denny's or someplace like that, you know, we'd have coffee and we'd sit around. And I'd watch Joe's humor against these other people in the community, and I think, he sure is a charmer. and he could see things in me, and gradually we'd get to the point that we really fell in love with the person we had become, and not the child. I mean, we got married at 24, but we were kids, you know? What do we know at 24? And the community helped us find each other and gave us that. So they were sort of our lifeboat until we got back and were able to rebuild it. And I think as a community, we have that responsibility to couples, not to condemn them and say, poo-poo on you, you know, you're divorced, you're outcast, out of the community, but to help them in their marriages. And if, with all of this help, their marriage fails, to help them get to God in the relationship that they're in after that.
I want to add one thing to that. The hardest part in our reconciling at that point was the fear of the other side. We knew what we had was gone. What lay on the other side? Mm-hmm. And it's better. It's great. But nobody hears that today. they say, boy, you really have a problem. You got to get rid of that person and go find another. You know, that's the easy American way today is
disposable.
Instead of, it can be better. You know, you had a pseudo community. It was a sham, let's face it. You know, we didn't know what we were getting into.
We played house for a long time.
And you enter this period of you don't know what you have, and you don't know if it will get better. But if we learn, if you work through it, it can be even better. But you don't see that often, because not many people stay together to show it.
And the ones that do are so quiet about it. If they have trouble, it's all hush-hush. Nobody in the Christian community hears about it. I mean, you withdraw from the
community. Yeah, you see somebody with a problem, you go the other way until they settle their difficulty.
Instead of letting it be known that, you know, you have trouble and you work through it. And if we're not vulnerable to each other that way in a Christian community, what good is it that we belong to the community? I mean, are we family to each other? Or are we just there to pretend?
Express the feeling that your friends and those who were around you, your family perhaps, supported you.
Your family, yeah.
I think that the Episcopalian order of marriage solicits, asks, perhaps even demands that those who are witnesses to that marriage will support that marriage in the troublesome times that may lie ahead. And I think we have to be more open about that. And as you said too, explain to those who are contemplating marriage and who come into it with a dewy-eyed, starry-eyed look, that it isn't always going to be that way. I think that's perhaps why mothers weep at marriages. I think they say, you won't even listen if I tell you now how bad it's going to be. Yeah. And I don't want to spoil your lovely day. Just as I think you should tell the babies when they're in their cradles, hey, you're crying because you're wet or hungry? Cheer up, it's going to get a lot worse. I mean, I can fix this now, but there are going to be things I can't fix. So live bravely through life, and we need support to do that.
I think we could do a whole forum on the ways in which the church could make some changes that way. It seems to me the task in front of us is, what do we as a community do with what Christ is saying about if you're divorced and want to get remarried, you're committing adultery?
Is that
well,
paralleled in another gospel? Or is it peculiar to Mark, the way it's
is there a variant on that?
Please.
I'm just curious, in the context.
Is that in the earliest manuscripts?
where's the loophole?
How about the question of the church's role in remarriage? We all know that there are some churches that it's very difficult for a divorced person to be remarried.
Can I talk about that? Because I am really upset about that issue. I am Roman Catholic, or I am Wittenberg Catholic. When we came up here 2 years ago, we met Ed Schrader and discussed what we believed and what we felt. And he said, well, you're not Roman Catholic. He said, you're Wittenberg Catholic. You're right there with Luther. What bothers me about the Catholic understanding, and yet I see where they're going with it, they're trying to emphasize that marriage is a very important aspect of our life. This mirror is better than any other sacrament what Christ's love is toward his people. But the problem is, the Catholic Church doesn't realize that we're human. So what they do is, when a relationship becomes irreconcilable, they say, well, you were only 22 or 23. Obviously, you were too immature to make a marriage, and therefore, it didn't exist. Well, it makes bastards of our children. And it doesn't solve the problem. It's really no help. They should say, yeah, you both made a big mistake. You're human. You made a big mistake. Both of you. reconcile in some way. Maybe you can't live together. Maybe there's somebody that you can live with better. But see, they are trying, the Catholic Church is trying to uphold this particular reading, or the way we have traditionally read it, you know, no divorce, in trying to come to terms with the current problem we have in this society, where we do mature and grow apart at times. And instead of saying, you made a big mistake, they just say, well, obviously there wasn't anything there in the beginning. And that's a shame, because I have a brother and a sister who had a good marriage and let it fall apart. But they had no support. And this gospel was written to a particular community. They just didn't say, well, what else did Jesus say? Let's write everything down. They took certain things that were important to that community. I mean, you can read it in 45 minutes, right? They said, okay, what is really important? For some reason, this was really important to the Christian community of that time. Not to the Jews, but to this new emerging community that was just thrown out of the synagogue.
Our biblical scholars find.
Not biblical scholars. A lot of people know about a synopsis of four gospels. It's a book that simply lines them all up in parallel, and you can read right across to see what it connects to. Going to Matthew, it says, "And I say to you, whoever divorces his wife except for unchastity and marries another commits adultery." Then it jumps back to Matthew 5, verse 31. It was also said, "Whoever divorces his wife, let him give her a certificate of divorce. But I say to you that everyone who divorces his wife except on the ground of unchastity makes her an adulteress. Whoever marries a divorced woman commits adultery." Luke 16, 18 says, "Everyone who divorces his wife and marries another commits adultery. And he who marries a woman divorced from her husband commits adultery."
It seems to me that in this whole section, and you started out reading, you put it in a context in which Jesus was talking about maiming yourself to enter the kingdom of God, if need be. It seems to me that the whole section is an example of Jesus lifting up and raising the truth of God and the demand of God to such a point where he won't negotiate on any of it, even though he understood that God told Moses to tell the people that because of their hardness of heart, they could write a divorce for certain things. I understood that from one of those texts. So it seems to me that Jesus is just speaking the truth in such a way that he will not lie about what God's original intention is for the creation and for life together. And I can't believe that if Jesus were here today and we could ask him what he meant, that he would say, well, what I mean is that all of you who have experienced the tragedy of divorce in your life could never have another love relationship that would be fulfilled in marriage. I don't think that's his intent. I can't hear that in this text. What I hear is that people want to live by rules and regulations and laws and figure everything out on that basis, they'll lose.
Yeah, he's counterpointing that one law of Moses with another law. Saying if you think you've got the loophole there, you come up against
it. Law to which we're all accountable. Mm-hmm.
Other comments or perspectives on the remarriage issue? Elmer in the Bible study the other day was talking about the marriages at which divorce is a kind of a relief. There are some marriages and relationships of such pain that It's for the safety and life of the people involved that they be divorced. What about remarriage? How would you approach this text with that question?
I think that obviously in everything we sin, and that, I mean, that's why we believe in there is grace. I think that Jesus set that up as an order for society to keep order, and if you have ever been in a, you know, in a divorced family, I mean, I was raised in a divorced family, and the chaos that creates, and it never ends forever. I mean, it goes on, because then when you get married and you have kids, and the grandparents are, you know, they're the divorced ones, and they can't see both at the same time. The problem is there forever in the family. It never leaves until you're all dead. But, and there's a lot of pain that goes along with that for your whole lifetime, and then your children's lifetime. And not that I wouldn't say to stay in marriages that aren't good, but I think that's just set up as an example to keep so that there is order in society. And if, you know, like I say, you do sin, and then there is grace, but it's kind of like an example of how it should be, but obviously it's not always going to work. But the, to know, but I do think people nowadays get out of marriages too easily. You know, people marry 3-5 years and they have problems, and then they just get divorced and they leave and they go find somebody else. You know, you don't stick it through. And if you've been married any length of time, I've been married 16 years, there's always ups and downs, you know. 3 years you may get along, the next two you know, might be down, and then it's up, and it's like that. But I think people don't wait long enough to see that through. They just want a fast society, and just dump that person and get a new one.
Let me raise a hypothetical situation. You're a pastor of a church. In walks a member of your congregation that's been divorced for 3 years, and this member says, I've fallen in love with somebody and would like to get married again, but Jesus says I'd be committing adultery. What do I do? Now, I know about grace and I know about forgiveness, so do I sin boldly? Or do I not do it? And I know, you know, Jesus' intentions are for me to be married and to live happily and to be a part of the community, but he said I'd be committing adultery. What do I do? You're the pastor.
I guess you would have to pray very hard.
Yeah.
And secondly, I guess for me, where does the law end and we begin to serve people and all of their sins? And I can't help but think that, you know, that Jesus was a forgiving Jesus, and you stated that. And in your decision making, we have to believe that he's going to forgive us and those persons who come to you for help in marriage. And we can look at the law, and we can also look at people. And as the lady said over there, it never ends, but people continue to live. And the question to me is, what do we do about the living? And again, where does the law begin and end in terms of people and the services that we as Christians can give to them?
I think one of the reasons he made that law was to protect people from going blindly into, you know, this relationship, and after 5 years another one, and after 3 years another one. Because the people who do that have got problems that they have to resolve within themselves before they can have a relationship with anybody. And therefore, you have to be careful, or it will be adultery. You will not have a relationship. And so I think that even after somebody's been divorced, if they have been divorced for years and have thought it through and resolved their own problem, then your marriage is not a sin. But if you're just going into this blindly, not thinking about why you couldn't live with your former spouse, that's worse than that.
And don't you think, too, I don't look at it as like going, you know, sin boldly. Don't you look at it as if that person is, if they, I mean, if you really feel, yes, you acknowledge that, yes, that I have sinned. You know, that I have sinned, and I'm sorry for that. And then you move on from there. You, and you're not just going out to do it to sin boldly, but you acknowledge that, yes, you have sinned. It is a sin. And you're sorry, and then you're, thus you're forgiven, and you're able to move on. You may, you know.
So just go ahead and do it, even though Jesus says don't, and then work at getting forgiven.
No, I think it's your attitude and your heart.
The issue Rich is raising is not so much that you've sinned when there's been a divorce, but there's a very clear, seemingly a very clear command not to remarry. So what are you going to do about that? It's, you know, it's sort of like you haven't done it yet. I mean, the sin is if you go ahead and do it again. I think that's what Rich is trying to raise. It's not what's happened, but there seems to be a clear word here about some future.
Well, what's next?
Yeah, what's next?
It seems to me that maybe that we do kind of center in on this one because of our hang-ups about sex, and this is the worst no-no in the world, and that Christians are often involved in very painful and ambiguous situations where we often don't quite know what the really right thing to do is. And I think just one example that I can think of is the commandment we have to honor our father and our mother, and Jesus reemphasized that. And yet some of us are put in a position at times to decide whether an aging parent, for example with Alzheimer's disease, can live with us, and what would that do to our home, or should they be put in a rest home of some sort. And sometimes situations like that can be just as painful and ambiguous, I guess you might say, as to whether we're doing God's will as this particular one. And I think you have to go ahead with love, and sometimes you never know if you're moving 100% in God's direction.
Yes, please.
I'm wondering if maybe what we should look at is whether you see adultery as an act or as a condition. And if you see it as an act, then like any other sin, it would be forgiven and you go on with your life. But if it's a condition, it may, you know, if it implies that if you remarry, then there's an ongoing sin that has not been forgiven. Otherwise, it seems like we make it a more important sin than any other sin. And we forgive almost anything else. So, but if it's sort of an ongoing state or condition in which you can't be forgiven as long as you remain in your second marriage, then that would, I would think, would really bother people. And I sometimes get the feeling that that's how the Catholic Church looks at it.
I think when we look at our churches, you'll find that most of our members are divorced if they come into the parish. And if you preach that kind of sermon, if you have divorced members who have remarried, I think that brings up a whole lot of issues. If marriages were made in heaven, then I think that we could address this from the heavenly standpoint. But we have been socialized so much about just the pleasure of living, and we don't really address the pains of living. We soon find something to dull those senses, and that seems to be the successful way of handling problems. So I think at a point of when you talk about adultery, and when you're looking at it from a Christian standpoint, and people are outside of that, they sometimes see the biggest sinners that is inside of the so-called Christian community. And I think the lady had a good point about we just don't talk about that as Christians because it's not supposed to happen to us. Somehow we're supposed to be above having those kinds of problems because we have Christ in our lives. So I think that a lot of issues need to be readdressed around what our own views are that's related to sex, divorce, and adultery, and remarriage, and all of the other issues that comes into the church. Because there are some points in there when it says an eye for an eye, a tooth for a tooth, or take out your eye if it offends you, you don't literally do that. There's other issues and ways that you look at those. So I just think that there has to be sort of a refocus in where you are and what you live with, because we don't all marry for the same reasons that God intended for us to marry.
Okay. Is there a comment over here? Yes, and then you.
One thing that seems to be kind of hazy, and it has been for me, is who is the her against whom he commits adultery as he remarries? And it has been helpful to me to hear the interpretation that it is the original wife. You know, by remarrying, he's solidifying or making final the breaking of the original relationship, which God intended to be for life. And Jesus does seem to make that pretty clear. Related to that, I guess, we were with William Lazarus at a conference talking about this thing, and he was saying, Jesus makes it real clear, divorce is a metaphysical impossibility. Because God has done something to create it. And I think, to me, the pain that this woman here was describing, that goes on and on and on and on, is a testimony to that. You know, that something was broken that couldn't really be broken, and the pain lingered. But it's not a state, it's an act of breaking, and not unforgivable. Jesus seems to make that clear with the woman in John 4, where he says, yeah, been married, what, 4 or 5 times, and the one you're living with now isn't your husband. He never backed down on the principle, but he sure dealt very graciously and said, ask me, I'll give you living water. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
I'm going to sit here trying to rack my brain and think of where the other couple passages are in the New Testament that also deal with divorce and possibly remarriage. Can anybody help with that? Maybe is there one in Corinthians?
1 Corinthians 7 is Paul does things with if you're married to someone that's not of the faith, he encourages you to stay with the person, but if that person chooses to leave the relationship, it's okay for you to let him go. And some denominations have done a lot of somersaults around that too.
I'd like to reflect on that, what was just shared there. If what you were sharing is accurate, then these words from Jesus, I suppose they're prescriptive, but they're even more descriptive, saying how it is. If there is a bond, a living bond that really is impossible to break in one sense, except by adultery, which disrupts it, then if you would remarry, you would have a situation, someone in a marriage that never could be ended, involved in another relationship that's can only be described as adulterous. It would be descriptive. And again, this seems to me to be Jesus' way of describing the human plight that we're in. What frightens me, if I can just one other comment, is I read statistics recently that suggested while we're near half the half divorce rate annually in the United States, that half of those people do in fact remarry within the first several years after their divorce, and that half of them again divorce within a matter of a year and a half or so, and that half of them again in turn remarry. And if what you described in your personal life is the way it is for so many people, there's a lot of ministry opportunities in the church.
Chuck?
Mm-hmm.
The reflection on the analogy with other kinds of human behavior that we, I think, understand as sinful, but nevertheless justify. War being a prime example. I think Christians have always said war is never a positive good. But some Christians, including the dominant traditions represented here, Roman Catholic, Lutheran, all of the non-peace church traditions, have said sometimes it's justifiable evil because it's a lesser evil than not to go to war under certain circumstances. That's the basis of the justifiable war ethic, which most of us probably subscribe to in one form or another, unless we are pacifists. There's an understanding of the nature of sin that says at times there is no way of not sinning. You are trapped in the human reality that whatever you do, you're going to be involved in sin. We seem to be more comfortable with that when it comes to war and violence than we are when it comes to marriage. And I don't know why that is. And maybe it goes back to Elmer's point about the particularity of sexual sinning as a major hang-up for humankind. And maybe there's some justification for that, for making that special. There may be. I mean, you were making the point, I think, that divorce is always a very serious business. The rupture of a marriage does not involve just two people. It involves generation after generation, like the sins being visited upon the generations to the third and fourth and more. But it just seems to me that we are somewhat inconsistent. We have a kind of doctrine of lesser evils that we can live with for certain kinds of evil, like war, which we concede is an evil, but we have a hard time applying that to other categories of human behavior, like marriage and divorce. And I think the Roman Catholics have accommodated themselves, as Lutherans have, to the evil of war rather comfortably, too comfortably to my mind. We hardly ever fret about that very much. But at least on this issue, your church has tried to hold the line. There was a time, I think, when Lutherans did too. We did not lightly remarry people. In more recent decades, we have, and we've justified it. We even have church statements that legitimate it now. But we still don't say that divorce is a positive good. I think we say it's a lesser evil at times than staying in a really rotten marriage, which I happen to believe is true.
Yeah, I guess my question is really summarized by the last three comments, and that is, what is the nature? To me, it seems like Jesus is alluding to some kind of mystical truth or relationship between a man and woman who have come together. And, is that true? Is there some kind of mystical relationship forming this act? And if so, if that can't be ever broken, it will always be there, even if there's a separation physically. And not in the sense of human order, but in the sense of some kind of spiritual truth about the world and creation and energy between people. So this is kind of my questioning. In that sense, yes, if anything else happens, that will always be there. And so any other relationship that comes into that will never be the same as it would have been. So I don't know about these things, but that's, I kind of feel maybe that's what he's speaking to. Of course, just saying this is the goal, this is the ideal. And then I don't know what that calls us to do. If we see that goal and believe that truth, if that really calls you then to live the rest of your life, if you can't live together in marriage, if that calls you to live apart from that kind of union.
I'm curious what that does to people who lose a spouse by death. Then there's no more marriage, and the next one can't be. You're still married to the energy somewhere. I don't know.
Well, Well, no, but yeah, to me that I'm confused even about what is the whole purpose of marriage on one level, of course, there's companionship, there's family, there's all of those human things, and I don't know.
But there's certainly lots of good marriages with no family, no offspring.
The other extreme, there's the Mormon view that the only way to get into heaven is to be married, so you marry as many times as you need to. Yeah.
We'll leave that one alone.
Yeah.
The time has come to formally conclude, and I want to thank you very much for the candor and the honesty and the receptivity with which you have addressed this difficult question. We need to conclude formally, but if people want to stick around and continue the conversation, please feel free to do that. Is there Compline tonight? There is not Compline tonight. But as you go to bed this night, and as you pray your prayers this night, bring to your remembrance dear and near people who are married or who have gone through divorce or who are widowed or widowers, and let marriage, remarriage, divorce be a focal point of your prayer this night. And thank you.